Hello, fellow prevention leaders. This is Dave Clawson, the host of the Pathways to Prevention podcast. Strap in for a mind-bending journey into the depths of addiction therapy with our guest, Christopher Smith, a seasoned trailblazer in the realm of addiction treatment. Christopher has spent over 20 years confronting and combating the pervasive challenges of substance addiction, particularly with cannabis. And in this episode, we're going to dismantle common misperceptions surrounding addiction, navigate its intricate landscapes, and peer into the groundbreaking approaches that are reshaping its therapeutic remedies. Christopher will introduce us to his unique method, which pivots the focus from the substance to the individual, fundamentally transforming the success rate of treatment. This episode is all about breaking chains, forging new paths, and illuminating the human potential for recovery. Ready to dive in? Let's go. The vision: a world where all people live free of the burden of drug abuse. This is the Drug Free America Foundation's Pathway to Prevention podcast, where we are committed to developing strategies that prevent drug use and promote sustained recovery. Thank you for not only tuning in, but your continued support and efforts to help make this world a better place. We hope you enjoy this episode. All right, podcast listeners, we are back for another episode, and I am excited and honored to welcome Christopher to the podcast. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Damon. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk to you and the audience.
Yes, indeed. I'm excited to learn more about you and about the work that you do. And to start off, would you give us a little preview, a little highlight as to kind of where you're at in this world and a little bit about the work you do?
Sure, absolutely. Located in Denmark, so that's a long way from the US. It's kind of in the middle of Europe, and that's where I go on about my living. But speaking of the work that I do, I'm working as a counselor, a therapist, been doing that for some 20 years now. And on the side, so to speak, I'm educating other counselors. And at this point, I don't know, stop counting, but, you know, plus 600 educated in Denmark. We work with cognitive therapy. We focus on cannabis addiction. So we have this special model, you could say, to help people out of their addiction. And then I guess a third thing I would add to the work that I do is, yeah, talking to you this moment and kind of letting people who are interested know about what's going on in Denmark, what's going on in Europe, and talking to people around me here, my network, of course, what's going on in the US, because you're kind of in many sense, a big brother, but also when it comes to legalization and experiences down that road.
I'm already taking notes on different topics or questions I'd love to dive into. But it's always fun to hear my guest's sort of origin story. Like, what led you to your current role?
Right. It wasn't a straightforward road, that's for sure. I started, you know, working with the finances. That was my main subject of study. And I had this idea that I would just, you know, change the world in terms of finances. And, you know, I was keen to the dream of, you know, making a lot of money. And yeah. And by coincidence, I took a break from my study. I needed some fresh air, some change. And it turned out to be quite a long break, and I needed something to do. So a friend of mine told me that there was a job opportunity as not a therapist or a counselor, but, you know, this place needed an adult that could have good conversations with adolescents, with young people, and not especially on the subject of substances or addiction, but just talk with an adult. And as you say, the rest is history, because I instantly fall in love with the conversation with young people being in a difficult situation at that point in life. And it made me realize two things: that I enjoyed it really well, and I was thrilled about talking with these young kids, and it worked really well. It's fair to say that at least the feedback, I was pretty good at it. So, you know, I went back to my studies and finished that, and immediately turned back to the job position, and been in it ever since.
Mm-hmm. I love it. I'm already seeing so many similarities in that. I love a good conversation, and I shared before we hit record that I was the motivational interviewing cop on a college campus, because I saw the power, the impact you could have in somebody's life with just slowing down and having a conversation with them. And I'm a fan of conversation methods, and I love it. I'm already getting fired up and excited about our conversation we're going to have here today as well. Before we get into some of those notes that I've already taken, what is going on in Europe when it comes to prevention and treatment?
Yeah, so maybe I should, you know, just take a step back, because when I started this journey, I really needed to understand what was going on. There was this paradox where people with substance abuse were getting treatment, but, you know, came out of treatment with, it took a long time, and they had to do several treatments, but at some point they were clean, so to speak. They quit the addiction, but they didn't really change their behavior in everyday life. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously they were living another life, but in terms of functioning, in terms of thinking, reflecting, solving your day-to-day problem, there wasn't really any change. And it kind of took me a while to figure out what was going on. And the problem was that they were still smoking cannabis. So they quit heroin or meth or whatever they were using, alcohol at that point, but they were still smoking cannabis. So you would see people that on the outside looked normal and maybe even had a job, maybe even were part of a family. And on the same time, they were really dependent on cannabis, and they were not really progressing in life the way you would normally see. And they had a hard time making decisions and being, so to speak, the best version of themselves. So a lot of people were paying the price, you could say, family members, work colleagues, people around these new clean addicts. And to this day, not only in Denmark, but in US and all around the world, it's still the problem. We don't see cannabis as part of the problem of substance use or addiction. I mean, we're getting there, but there's still a lot of work to do. And that's kind of the challenge if you are a counselor like me, if you work with therapy and you're trying to help people quit the addiction, you really need to have a deep insight on cannabis, what it's doing short-term, long-term, to the brain, to the way we function in daily life. And so much so that you need to address cannabis before you address any of the other substance use. And I know that might sound a bit controversy, why not go right for the cocaine or the alcohol? But again, cannabis is kind of, you know, setting the pace in terms of how you function obviously the other drugs do as well. But there's something different about cannabis in the way we are able to think and solve our problem. And here's the really important point. Our ability to check in with ourselves, whether we are doing a good job in solving problems or not. So that's kind of the environment that we are operating in. And so if you look abroad and to the Europe as a whole, it's almost a third of all drug treatment emissions in Europe at this point. So cannabis is the main problem drug that is most frequently cited by new treatment clients. So we have this undervalued, this not dangerous drug here, but in treatment, it's the main cause why people want treatment. And on the same time, we lack this deeper understanding on what's really going on. And as you've seen, we see it in Europe as well. The availability of high potency extracts, edibles, and so on is flooding the market. And it's linked to acute toxicity. And we see it in the emergency rooms in hospitals as well. So it's kind of a sad story all in all. But, you know, there's kind of, you know, two horses that you can bet on, so to speak, and we should do both, but prevention or treatment. And I think the way we go about treatment at this point, Denmark and Europe, maybe in US, I don't know, but it's kind of, I mean, the last book I wrote about treatment and rhetoric and evidence, adverse health effects, and so on. I kind of put all of it together. And, you know, the problem is that we have a hard time understanding what is going on and kind of focus a lot of treatment. We want to, you know, kind of take control of the problem. Obviously, we want to help these people who are caught in addiction, but we're kind of, the way we treat, we kind of, in the book I write about how treatment is part of the problem and that we are really not preventing others from getting into addiction, partly because the way we talk about it and our lack of understanding, and partly by the way we are doing treatment. Let me give you an example. So it's pretty normal, at least in Denmark, that counselors don't understand what's going on with cannabis and the brain, short term, long term.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of think that this is a soft drug and you can smoke cannabis occasionally. It's not a problem. So we kind of reproduce the problem. We kind of, you know, add to the problem by not understanding what's going on. And I mean, I hear counselors saying, you know, if you could you just, you know, smoke a bit less, maybe keep it to Sunday or to the weekend so you can get up in school Monday morning. And I mean, the first thing you learn about cannabis and cognition and the way it impacts the brain is that this is not your Woodstock weed, right?
Mm.
It's a lot more potent. And the time it takes to leave the body for a person that smokes every now and then is 6 weeks. So this is not alcohol. This is not, you know, leaving your body and not influencing your way of doing things and making decisions, solving problem after a day or two. No, it's 6 weeks. So in that respect, people are going around being intoxicated all the time, being impaired in terms of cognition.
I actually just saw Dr. Jason Kilmer, who's a friend and colleague, speak last week. And I've heard him say it before, but it always just really grabs my attention. It's like, oh my gosh. And that he uses the research to show that many of the reasons, self-reported reasons for cannabis use, folks are saying, are also the symptoms of cannabis withdrawal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's just this cycle. And yeah. And yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. So it's adding to the problem, right? So it starts being some kind of recreational use, and you know, you're hanging out with your friends and you just want to have a good time. And all of a sudden it's kind of and this is a necessity in terms of, you know, just being able to have a reasonable level of functioning.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and as you say, dealing with the effects of the drug.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when you were sharing a little bit, which I want to get into the model, not yet though, but what was coming to mind for me is that when somebody comes in for treatment and they're using cannabis on an occasional, regular basis, whatever that may be, but they're coming into treatment for a different substance, that your approach, it really looks at cannabis as the first domino, so to speak, that when you focus on shifting how they think about cannabis, will then be that domino effect and tip over to help create momentum for the other substances as well. That was kind of my summary, but I'm also not a treatment provider.
That's beautifully put. Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm. And, you know, what I've discovered over the years teaching this model is that people are, and they should be, concerned about all the hard drugs. So, and as I say, they kind of, you know, give you a free pass for smoking, and it's not really a big deal. But what we have discovered is when, as you say, when we make way for the person to actually have a working mind again, being able to reflect and think and solve problems the best possible way, we start seeing a ripple effect on how this rise in cognition makes them able to control a cocaine addiction. I mean, what you would normally do with cocaine addiction is that you would work with triggers and strategies. So, identifying triggers, that could be obviously specific situations in your daily life with some people or special place. It could also be other substances. It could be alcohol, for one. So you kind of take your time to identify these triggers and you say, so, well, okay, now we know where you are, kind of the risk situations. Here are where you might use cocaine. So in order to avoid that, let's do some strategic thinking. Let's make some strategies that helps you avoid these triggers. And so the counselor would sit down, obviously, with the patient, and they would do really thorough and, I mean, it make good sense, really thorough work, planning strategies to avoid these triggers. And what we see in treatment is that it's possible to plan a strategy. It's possible to go out, at least most of the times, go out and, you know, kind of work with this strategy. And it might also, in some cases, be possible to come back and have a qualitative talk about, so what went on? How did it go? Were you able to use your strategy? But the last part is the most important. So now that you've used the strategy, you have some experiences, what do you see as adjustment point? What needs to be added or changed in the strategy so that you can, you know, do it even better next time. So all of these are different types of cognitive work takes cognition. And that's exactly what the cannabis addicted misses. And especially the last part about kind of reflecting on how the strategy went down and if you need to adjust something is very impaired with cannabis addiction. It's what we call the executive functions. And I mean, it's really hard to make any change, not only in substance use, but also in life as a whole, if you lose your ability to think and reflect and, you know, do things better from time to time.
You said a very important word right there, that reflect, and that the example with a cocaine addiction, I feel that that power is in that reflection at the end, now that you've had some experience. But what I'm hearing is, if you're using cannabis, that's going to impede, that's going to impact your ability to really reflect on your behavior related to other substances.
Absolutely. So if you take a good look at a person who's in a cannabis addiction, you will see this person repeating mistakes over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And if you point it out to them and ask them, so you keep making the same mistakes, you know, what's going on? Why not, you know, change it? If they, I was just about to say they're honest. That's not, I mean, and that's, it's not them being not honest, but it's the stigma of having an addiction that makes it hard sometimes for the addicted to say what's, you know, really going on. But if they would give you what we see, at least clinically, the right answer, they would say, I can't even really tell you what, why. I mean, I make these mistakes, but I don't know why. Mm-hmm. I can see the mistakes, but I'm not able to kind of look behind and identify why these mistakes are happening. So, and the really sad part about that is that at some point, and I get that, the person stops trying. And that's why you see cannabis addicted kind of withdraw from society. They finally, you know, find a reason to quit the job, to leave the family, because it's very, speaking of stigma, it's very, I mean, who would love to go around in a world where you were constantly reminded that you couldn't meet expectations, feeling dumb? I mean, I would stop seeing people if I was making the same mistakes over and over, because at some point, I mean, you're looking at this person, you don't know what's going on. At some point, people would kind of, you know, say, what's going on with this person? Why isn't he changing? And so we have a lot of issues with getting people back in the game, so to speak, getting people to, first of all, get cognition back. So we are kind of, you know, rebuilding cognition in treatment, but we also need them to get into the field and start playing again, so to speak, right? So mm-hmm. there's a very big consequence here in when we speak social interaction. So as I said, we see this drawing back from social interactions, but also, as I say, a problem when they kind of, you know, want to get back into the game, want to, you know.
Mm-hmm. I'm feeling that lack of hope and that how that fuels the withdrawal, and just kind of relating that to my own personal experience with alcohol. And a couple different times as I've been listening, and I've been reminded of a quote that I'll probably mess it up a little bit, but I'm guessing you'll get what I'm trying to put down here, is that if you want to change your behavior, you have to change your feelings. And if you want to change your feelings, you have to change how you think. And the longer that I've been in sobriety, the more and more I see that now, reflecting back on my journey and even just where I'm at right now, the way I think about substances, the way I think about wellness, about being my best self, influences, it shapes how I feel. And then that also helps my behavior. But I'll just hit pause because,
Great. Yeah. And, you know, it's kind of another discussion. And then again, it's not, because it's, you know, we're not islands separated, floating around in this ocean. We're, you know, we understand who we are by meeting other people. And so being a part of it all is kind of a premise for being alive, obviously, but it's also a very, I sometimes think to myself that I'm really glad that I'm not, you know, like 15 again, because this world has really changed. And I'm not sure I like the pace and all the things that's going on. So on a deep level, I really understand how people need to pause and kind of, you know, stop the craziness and get some kind of emotional break. And that's exactly what these substances do. They kind of disconnect thoughts and feelings. And that's very nice, because then you don't have to think about your feelings. But on the other hand, if feelings are a part of, you know, tapping into who we are and making good decisions and, you know, dealing with all this craziness, you're kind of lost. So, and you can get both. So if you want to disconnect from your feelings, you lose the ability to make good decisions and live the life that you want to.
I keep taking us off on tangents, but as I look here on my desk, my new journal prompts really are intended for me to sit with my feelings more. Part of my post-traumatic stress disorder is that I wouldn't let myself have feelings. I try to keep it all locked up and never spent time allowing myself to feel, let alone understand and processing them. And so my journal prompts, as I hold up my notepad here and read them, it's that I have to answer these questions. Mm-hmm. I feel .. Mm-hmm. I need .. I celebrate, and I release.
Yeah.
Just that the ability for folks to be able to in a healthy manner, sit with their emotions.
Yeah.
It's hard.
I mean, it's, I mean, at this point in time, it's probably the hardest thing. And if it's kind of self-inflicted, right? Because the way we're living our lives. And I'm really saddened by the state of the minds. I mean, this is, you probably heard it as well, but I hear it all the time when I'm talking to politicians and other lawmakers and policymakers and so on. And they keep saying, you know, we lost the war on drugs, but to cite Bertha Madras, it is not a war on drugs. It's defense of the young people's brain. And so it's, you know, it's very, at sometimes it's very frustrating, you know, understanding kind of the premise for being and adolescent today. And on the other side, I mean, it's a good thing to help them with, you know, true treatment, but it's kind of the end station of life where they haven't got control, at least that how they feel from time to time over, you know, their situation, their future, their feelings. And they kind of, at least some of them, end up in my chair, right? And having to do treatment. And you mentioned trauma. So there's this Canadian physician, Gabor Maté, who says, it's not why the addiction, it's why the pain. And I'm seeing that treatment, and rightly so, is getting more trauma-informed these years. And it should be, because when you see the addiction, it's the top of the iceberg, right? There's something underneath the, I mean, it's not the addiction or the substance use that's a problem. It's the way that this person tried to deal with the problems. Mm-hmm. So it's not why the addiction, it's why what happened to you. So what make you, I mean, it's not a choice really, but what make you choose cannabis, for instance? How was that helpful to solve your feelings or your sense of, you know, not being in control at that point of life?
Absolutely. And yeah, just to add real life examples from my story, when I came back from my combat deployment in Iraq and I was suffering with post-traumatic stress disorder and addiction and an undiagnosed traumatic brain injury, I didn't feel like I fit in and I felt different. And I had these emotions and feelings that I didn't know how to process, how to work through, both from my trauma, but then also just wanting to fit in. And those kind of stacked on top of each other. And rather than learn, get support to work through those emotions, I drank. And in my mind at the time, that was a way to fit in on a college campus. I could fit in and, quote, feel like I belong, and also not have to deal with my emotions that I didn't understand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, the feeling, I mean, it's really, it's life and death, the feeling of belonging. And that's what every person on this planet is craving for, right? We want to be identified as being part of a group or certain kind of, you know, people, a community, whatever it is. And sometimes the ticket you have to buy to get to those networks or communities is drugs. It's a way kind of back to normal. But what it does is it takes the ability to be normal, to function in that community. So you kind of start as an outcast and you end as one. You get excluded from the community when the, you know, consequences of the addiction kicks in.
I'm going to remember that. You start as an outcast, and through addiction, you often end up as an outcast. Yeah, wow. I've never heard it said like that. And I'm just looking back at my own story like, oh my gosh, yes. Yeah. Wow. I don't even remember where we're going to go with this conversation because I'm just so lost in that thought. Wow. Yes. Yeah.
Sorry. Just to say, that's the whole point of, you know, we're both obviously obsessed with the conversation, right? That just a chance to, you know, understand something or get a new perspective. And that's kind of, obviously I want to help people when they're in addiction. I want to, you know, kind of bring them back into community and by my small effort, you know, kind of be a stepping stone back to whatever they identify as meaningful. But it's, on the same time, it's really, even when I don't succeed, I should say they succeed because they're doing all the work. Mm-hmm. It's still a blessing to be a part of that conversation because, you know, talking to people in pain, just to be able to listen to their pain, the way they, you know, talk about it, whichever way that makes sense for them, is a privilege. And I'm really honored that people will, you know, engage in a conversation with me because, I mean, who am I to, I'm just a person, you know, with some, sure, I have some knowledge and I have some clinical experience and I could go on all day about adverse health effects, but the point here is that, I mean, and this is translatable to life in general, but to quit an addiction, you need two things to come true. You need to find your own reason for quitting, and you need to find your own way out of the addiction. So as a counselor or clinician or therapist, I need to be really clear that I facilitate those two conditions and that I'm not kind of, you know, forcing some kind of reason for quitting cannabis or saying you should do this or you should do that or why haven't you thought of that? I mean, my primary task is to kind of explore with them what makes sense in their life at this point and what would be, if at all, what would be a first step in a new direction. So supporting their view on things, not interfering, not kind of putting a truth over their head. And whenever they start or feel like taking a first step, support it as much as I can.
What other insights or wisdom could you share in relation to your model, to your approach?
Yeah. I know this might sound strange, maybe, but really, we call it HAP, and it's in Danish, the cannabis, the word for cannabis in Danish would be hash, or you know it as hashes. But so it's hash afvænningsprogram, HAP. So yeah, treatment model or program for quitting cannabis addiction. And I mean, obviously I'm not seeing everything what's going on, but working as a clinician and as a person that educates other clinicians, you know, talking to a network here and abroad and all over the world, I'm not seeing everything, but I have a reasonable idea on what's going on in terms of prevention and treatment. And to this day, I haven't come across any treatment model that is, you know, focusing on cannabis. It's, if you look to treatment models, you will see general tools for solving specific problems. So it's fair to say that there's a quite substantial body of evidence for cognitive therapy. I know it's still a discussion point, but it seems to work pretty good overall. Not for all problems, of course, but overall. But hopefully what I got across is, you know, dealing with a cannabis addiction is kind of another ball game. So you can't just, I mean, if the only thing you got in your toolbox is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And as I mentioned in the beginning, I was fascinated by seeing people quitting 20 years of heroin addiction. And I mean, I was really impressed. And but the really sad message, as I say, was there weren't really any functional difference. So this model specific looks to what are the conditions when you're in a cannabis addiction. And there's kind of this, we normally say that you get an education in cannabis. There's some things we need to learn the user about what is really going on when you use cannabis. And I haven't seen any model out there addressing it in the same way. And that's probably why pretty much treatment doesn't work. I mean, in the latest book, I deconstruct the kind of the guideline in Denmark, how you need to do treatment if you want to be successful, if you want to help addicts quit their addiction. And it's working really bad. I mean, half of the time, we're not helping people. And the half that is not helped, so every other person drops out of treatment before treatment is concluded. And I'm pretty sure it's due to our lack of understanding the problem. And on that note on efficiency of treatment, when we look into the half that is actually helped, they're not really helped. Because, I mean, it's evidence, it's out there. It's just, you know, you can Google it and you can see the guideline, the model in Denmark, and you're defining result or being clean by being at least 1 month clean of cannabis. So when treatment concluded, you would at some point check in again to make sure that the result is still there. So people, you know, judge whether it's still a result on the fact that you need at least 1 month clean time. But the first page in the book on neuropsychology and cannabis cognitive impairment will tell you that it takes 6 weeks. So a lot of these people haven't really received any help. They haven't really got any result. Best case, they have a long break from cannabis.
1 month compared to 6 weeks. That just makes me shake my head and like, wait a second.
You know, just talking about it, that's what keeps me up at night, or it makes me jump out of bed in the morning, because it's so frustrating. And that's, you know, kind of the reason for saying that we are fueling the fire here. We're part of the problem. Looking at the substances or the substance cannabis in this way, it kind of, you know, imagine the frustration. You finally got the courage to reach out. I mean, for people in addiction, it takes years, right? And maybe a lot of tries. At some point, you reach out. And so you start treatment and you haven't, you know, there's not really a lot of motivation or not a lot of hope, and you're really scared that this might, you know, send you right back to where you came from. And then you get into treatment, and then you hear counselors talk about cannabis as you hear it talked about on the streets. And so they're not really telling you something new. They're not really educating you. And by that, not really giving you a reason to quit. It's kind of the same rhetoric that you hear when you come into treatment. And because the person in front of you, you know, really doesn't bring anything new to the table, don't answer to why you can't sleep a night without smoking, why you keep, you know, exploding with your girlfriend, whatever it is, they drop out of treatment and they go right back to the addiction. And they tell their mates that, you know, I had this counselor and he said, well, it's not really a problem. You just need to get the control back. So if you can just, you know, smoke a bit less and keep it to the weekends, you'll be all right. So, I mean, in my darkest moments, I just want to quit. I want to get out. I want to go back to finances or, you know, do something completely different. But yeah, so it's a blessing to be a part of, you know, the conversation, but it's always also with a drop of frustration and indignation. I mean, I'm fired up about the way we say that we want to help these people, but we don't really help them. And not because we don't know how or haven't got access to whatever it is that would help them. Really, I can't tell you why. I mean, part of it is probably because counselors like me, you know, we want to do a good job. So we have a problem when someone challenges that and says, so, I mean, as a counselor, there's always three questions that you should be able to answer. So if you were working as a counselor and I would come to your house at night and wake you up and say, so, Dave, answer these three questions, you should be able to answer them instantly. And the first question is obviously, so how many patients are going through your door? How many patients do you actually help? And thirdly, how many patients drop out of the treatment that you provide? And when I'm traveling around, no one can answer those questions. Maybe the first one. And what worse is they don't really, by not having those numbers, they don't have a setup to try to understand, is what I'm doing really does it have any effect? And, you know, so that takes us back to really taking responsibility for the conversation, being the best you when you're going into that conversation. In the book, I write about what makes therapists perform at the highest level. So there's this phenomena, deliberate praxis, that teaches us that talent is overrated. Training is more important. So you can be a really good football player or a really good therapist with a fairly small amount of talent, but with the right type of training. So I would love to see therapists, and I know we have to pave the way, but I would love to see therapists, not only in Denmark, but all over, be more dedicated to be their best version. Being open for, you know, my level of performance at this point. And sometime that level suck. It's really bad. But at least now I know. And I can reach out and I can get some help. And I can do better. Because, I mean, we are on this game and you're doing this podcast. And, you know, every one of us who's working with this in some shape or form have one objective. We want to help. And being in that conversation where you have been chosen, where you are the one that is to provide that help, puts a lot of response on our shoulders. And at this point, we're not taking it seriously. And the really, if I can just add that, the really sad part about it, and I see that all the time, is when it doesn't work, when treatment doesn't work, we blame the patient. I hear on a daily basis, because, you know, the patients come into us, or I talk to fellow therapists. It's so often, it's kind of the new normal that patients are thrown out of treatment because with the message, well, you're not motivated. And when I say to therapists that kind of disqualifies patients that way, is that I say, sorry, he's not motivated with you. A very important thing about cannabis is that, as we talked about earlier, you're not able to see how you work, how you are able to solve everyday problem. And that kind of makes you blind for changing. So, at least when we speak to cannabis, seeing that I have a problem is not a matter of choice or will. It's a capacity in the brain that is not there. So I use this metaphor with a normally functioning brain would have a helicopter that would, you know, supervise whatever is going on in your life and sending you feedback real time, letting you know whether you perform in a way that makes you meet the standards or expectations or not, which give you a chance to, you know, adjust and do better. But that helicopter is crashed when you smoke cannabis. So people are going around in a world and thinking everything is hunky-dory, everything is good. It's obviously all the other people who misunderstands me. So you can see it's really on us to help them kind of understand what is going on. And my experience with working this way is the minute they see how their ability to understand what's really the problem and why they were in that prison, so to speak, two things happen. They immediately start reducing and they say, so this is why my life doesn't function. How can I, you know, what can we do? How can I get back to a normal life where things are functioning again? And that's kind of the treatment model. We have this part where we educate them, and we have this part where we sort of help them make the transition back to the community. So it's partly, you know, there's a physical focus, and there's a mental focus, and there's a social focus where we want to integrate them back into the community after treatment.
When you're talking about the therapists and, you know, having that mindset of continued growth, continued learning, wanting to be your best, I had a couple things come to mind. One being, this might age me a little bit, but here in the US, Michael Jordan, basketball player, even Michael Jordan had a coach to help him improve his game. And he practiced. And he needed a coach. And the other thought that I had too actually comes from my father. A piece of wisdom that he shared with me is that, you know, you might hear, oh, you need to lead by example. But he told me, throw that thought out the window, because it's one thing to show up to work, put on your uniform, put on your hat, and check the box and, you know, quote, do what you're supposed to do. But if you want to lead by example, you need to live by example, that authenticity. And that's what will inspire folks to follow you. And I was kind of relating that to how you're talking about therapists, and we or therapists need to live by example, not necessarily be perfect, but model those healthy behaviors, those norms, that continued learning, get educated, ask for help, learn to grow. All of those positive norms, we need to model those as well.
Exactly. That's, I mean, well put. I normally say that, you know, we are a role model, and what defines whether you are qualified as a role model or not is how you behave when nobody is looking.
The power of a role model, being a new father, my wife and I kind of joke, she teases me a little bit that pretty soon I'm going to have to start eating my vegetables because I want to be a good role model for our daughter.
It's like,
oh goodness. Yeah. We've been chatting for some time now, and want to kind of start to close out this wonderful conversation. We could chat for hours and hours on end, I can tell, but want to ask two remaining questions for you.
Sure.
One being, how can our listeners get connected with you or stay up to date or even get your books?
Right. So, the first book I wrote back in 2013. It was a book on parenting and to the point on helping your son or daughter quitting the cannabis addiction. I'm glad to say that it's translated into English, so it's accessible. It's called Teens Using Cannabis, A Guide for Concerned Parents. And I would really, at this point, I haven't, my webpage isn't on English, but you know, there's, you could find your way around and contact me, and you know, I could send you the book. It's not a problem. I do that all the time. And so that would be one resource. And it's just a note on that. So what, I mean, till this day, I have to, you know, sometimes I can't believe it's true, but what we discovered with that book was that it was possible to help people out of addiction without even talking to them. The only intervention was talking to the parents.
Mm-hmm.
So it tells you how much, obviously, influence parents have, not only on adolescents, but also pretty grown up people. I mean, in their mid-20s or whatever. So it's a how-to book, and it takes you through the different phases on what's going on if you have a teenage kid at home, and based on, sadly, but real praxis, real evidence, what not to do, and then, of course, what to do instead. If you are, so that would be a resource for parents or just people who want to, you know, dive into, maybe you're in a relationship with someone with a cannabis addiction and you want to understand how to, you know, be the best kind of help you could be. The other book is, and I'm sorry for the title, but you know, it's a big ocean out there, and I want to make a dent in the universe. So the book is called The Most Important Book You Ever Read About Cannabis. it's a bit big, I know, but really it's kind of 20 years of clinical experience and what I've seen and heard with nearly daily conversations with cannabis users over the years. I just kind of, you know, empty my head into the paper in front of me, and that became the book. And what's really interesting about the book is it takes you around, you know, all that we have been talking about here, and it provides the treatment model. And there's, on top of that, the, you know, guided praxis if you want to perform like the top 10% therapist. I kind of lay out the model there. So there's a model of, you know, quitting cannabis addiction. And in addition to that, the model on how to be a, I think they are called super shrinks, the therapists that, you know, really, really do a different difference. So yeah, that would be two resources. And as we talked about before we went on the podcast here, this is my debut. So thank you, Dave, for having me. I mean, I hope in the future I can, you know, look back on a lot of podcasts like this. I find it very inspiring. And again, thank you very much for having me.
I may have already made a mental note of two of our past episodes to send you that I think you might find interesting.
Awesome. Please do. Thanks.
My last question, if you're ready for it.
Let's go.
All right. If you were to tell our listeners, if you're going to remember one thing from this episode, remember this. What would that be?
That's a very good question.
You can take as much time as you need. I know it's a big one.
Yeah, it is. It is. Wow. Honestly, I feel that there was a lot of things that you said that were really profound and I mean, gold nuggets. Yeah, I guess I would say that I'm not sure how much we talked about it, but if I could, you know, just one chance to get one message across, I would say, and I know it's a bit, might be a bit political, but be careful what you think about what you learn from the media and in some instances, lawmakers and politicians in terms of what is real evidence on cannabis. And, you know, when I started this journey, I guess I did as many people are doing today, parents and kids that want to know what is really going on with this substance. And so, you know, Dr. Google, what's cannabis? And, and you get like, I don't know, 50 million hits, right? And you can start sorting out. And I went in on that journey as well. And, you know, I was exhausted and came to that realization that I haven't got the capacity to, you know, and I would guess parents or kids don't either, but to kind of deconstruct all this information. So what I did was I reached out to, it could be Drug-Free America. It could be, you know, in my case, I reached out to scientists and people who really understood this on a deeper level. And I know reaching out to a scientist is not really within the possibilities of people just going about their life. I want to understand these complex things. But what you could do is, you know, so whenever you hear something, look in your community, reach out to at least get a second opinion. And that's partly why I wrote the last book. I mean, it's filled up with evidence. And so you can disagree, but you know, you're not disagreeing with me, you're disagreeing with science. So that's perfectly okay. But I mean, we need to have a reference point in this discussion. Whether we talk prevention, treatment, legalization, decriminalization, we need to, you know, kind of be on the same, at least starting page. So to boil that down, don't underestimate cannabis. I mean, it's, you know, make sure that you reach out and get a second opinion about what's really going on. Because if you don't, you will be presented, and it's here in Denmark, but I feel it's very strong in the US, with a certain kind of narrative that this is not a problem. And it should be used actually, because it's kind of a vitamin, or, you know, some kind of, it helps you with all your problems, when really it takes the ability to solve the problems in your life.
I definitely put you on the spot with that question, but beautiful, beautiful wisdom, beautiful wisdom. And with that, I want to take it back to actually my very first question when you shared that you wanted to change the world through finance. And I'll push back and say you are changing the world on a huge, big scale through all of those single individual conversations that you're having, that you are a part of. So thank you for changing the world and being who you are. It's been an honor, and I can't wait till our next conversation, because it's been an absolute delight.
Thank you very much, Dave. Thank you for the kind words. And, you know, hearing it from a person who knows what's going on and is concerned with these problems, it makes all the difference. So thank you very much. It's really encouraging, and I promise you to push on and do some more work.
Marvelous. Keep on keeping on, because prevention is better together.
Exactly. Thank you.
That concludes this episode. Thanks for tuning in. Be sure to hit the subscribe button and share this episode with a friend before you leave. And we look forward to seeing you on social media, because prevention is better together. Together, we are stronger.